Matt and I am here this afternoon for a little pipeweed on the porch conversation with Trish Lambert, who is a current student at the Mythgard Institute and who is also serving as co-host of the Riddles in the Dark Digest with Dave Kao and has been helping us with the Riddles in the Dark stuff lately. And Trish wrote a very interesting paper for the Lewis and Tolkien class that I taught in the spring at Mythgard. And we wanted to talk about that because, of course, it's relevant to a lot of the sort of stuff that's going on, thinking about The Hobbit and The Hobbit movie and everything else that's coming up. And she wrote her paper on The Hobbit and Snow White, which a lot of people don't even realize how closely those two things came out together, the sort of the coincidence between the emergence of Tolkien and the emergence of Walt Disney at around the same time. And I had never given that a moment's thought in my entire life until Trish's paper, and I was really interested to think about this. So I thought it would make a fun topic of conversation. So welcome, Trish.
Well, thank you very much. You know, we should actually let the listeners know that even though we're calling this pipeweed on the porch, neither of us actually smoke.
Yes, exactly. No, it's always very purely figuratively pipeweed for me. I really appreciate the ideal of pipeweed and smoking that Tolkien depicts in his books, though it is true that real life smoking I find rather repugnant, but I always like the idea of it the way Tolkien describes it.
I know in Middle Earth I guess it must not have any health consequences whatsoever,
apparently.
So,
not,
you know,
so yeah, that's
pretty cool.
That's lovely. But anyway, so tell everybody some more about Snow White and the Hobbit. Let's first start with basically sort of the historical and chronological facts, of which I think a lot of people probably aren't really aware.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I would, like you, it hadn't really dawned on me, and I think it just happened in passing that I noticed that Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which I had already, of course, known was sort of this landmark movie because it was Disney's. It was not only Disney's, but it was the very first full-length animated feature ever. But it was interesting when I noticed that she was also having her 75th anniversary, and I looked at the dates closer, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, the publication of The Hobbit and the release of Snow White were literally within months of one another. And so I started looking into this further, and then I got to thinking about the two men, because whether you like them or not, both Walt Disney and J.R.R. Tolkien are, you know, giants among the fantasy, in the fantasy genre these days.
Absolutely.
And to have this be so close and track so close, I kind of wanted to look a little closer, not only at the stories themselves, but at the men themselves. So basically, the Hobbit was released in London, in England, in September 1937. Mm-hmm. December 1937, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs came out in the U.S. The following year, The Princess and the Hobbit went across the ocean in opposite directions. So we got The Hobbit by Houghton Mifflin in 1938, and Britain got Snow White in 1938. So they are very close together.
Yeah, that really is a remarkable thing. Because, of course, as soon as you think about it, you know, you start noticing this stuff, right? I mean, like, you've got the incredible coincidence of the party of dwarves,
right?
Which is such a coincidence that you know, as you were asking in your paper, like, it's, you know, one has to ask, like, is there any influence one direction or the other? Is it just a coincidence that these two guys told the same, you know, sort of groundbreaking fantasy stories containing a large party of dwarves at the same time?
I know. And also, you had mentioned to me a while back about John Ratliff in his book makes a note, and I actually mentioned this in my paper, and it's just a passing note in his book, but the fact that until Tolkien wrote The Hobbit, dwarves in his legendarium had not been good guys.
Yeah, it's one of the big sort of mysteries, I guess, if you want to call it a mystery, about The Hobbit is, of course, it doesn't strike anybody who comes to Tolkien's works the way that people normally do. That is, if you start off reading The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, you begin with this idea of these noble dwarves who are, you know, who have their issues, you know. I mean, you know, Thorin has his gold problem, and we know that dwarves tend to be, you know, vengeful and secretive, and, you know, it's as you say, it's not that they don't have issues, but basically they're free folk. They're part of the good
right.
guys. But you know, John Ratliff makes a great point of this in his book, The History of the Hobbit, that if you came to the Hobbit from the other direction, that is chronologically from Tolkien's works in his lifetime, if you go back and look at the writings Tolkien had been doing leading up to the Hobbit, of course, though it was the first, you know, major work of fiction he published, was certainly not the first one that he wrote. He had been writing stuff which would later on eventually become the Silmarillion for a long time, including the stuff which was published by Christopher Tolkien as the Book of Lost Tales, Volume 1 and 2, back in the teens and 20s. And if you read all that stuff, all of the Silmarillion, the Book of Lost Tales stuff, the Lays of Beleriand, which are these, you know, these long poetic versions of the story of Túrin, Túrinbar, and the story of Beren and Lúthien, that he had been writing just before he was writing The Hobbit, all of this stuff, you look at all this stuff, and the dwarves don't look anything like Thorin and company. I mean, they're right. Bad guys. They're allies with the orcs. They're lumped in with orcs and trolls. As in fact, you know, sometimes they're included in the category called Children of Morgoth. So dwarves are not just, you know, people who, you know, like good guys who have issues with elves and are, you know, tend to be secretive. They were genuine villains. As is more consistent, dwarves usually are villains. If you look at, you know, at you know, many, you know, like Norse epics, at medieval literature, dwarves are usually, you know, sometimes dwarves in medieval literature are comparatively, you know, are just sort of like servant figures. I'm thinking, for instance, of in Sir Thomas Malory, when, you know, occasionally you'll have a dwarf serving as like a squire to a knight,
right.
You know, and, yeah, in leading to one of my favorite moments in Malory, in the tale of Sir Gareth, when Sir Gareth's dwarf gets stolen by somebody and he goes pelting after him saying, "Give me back my dwarf! Give me back my dwarf!" But anyway, hilarity ensues. But anyway, you know, in general, they were really nasty. So Thorin and company, when they show up at Bilbo's house in The Hobbit, all of a sudden they're good guys, and there's no transition, there's no explanation. We don't see. I mean, apparently Tolkien has just at this time, when he wrote The Hobbit, changed his mind and decided to make the dwarves good guys, or at least mostly good guys. And that's just that in the context of Tolkien's imagining, you know, it's sort of his subcreation, that came out of nowhere. So again, that's another thing to say, like, all of a sudden there are these like friendly dwarves showing up, and, you know, at the same time that we have this other, you know, sort of dwarf film. Now, of course, Snow White is based on the Brothers Grimm, and, you know, we've got, we get that story in the Brothers Grimm. We get it in Andrew Lang, you know, called Snowdrop. And there are dwarves in there that are relatively kindly. I mean, they don't do anything mean. They kind of adopt Snowdrop. They're kind of non characters, especially in Andrew Lang's version, they don't really do much other than find her and then tell her, give her good advice, which she completely ignores, and then mourn after her when she dies again, as she dies several times, because the character of Snowdrop in that story is just about the dumbest character I have ever seen. I mean, like, the Wicked Witch poisons her three separate times, and she falls for it every single time, and the dwarves are like, don't take anything from anybody who comes by the house trying to give you something. And she's like, well, surely this old lady is an exception. Anyway, but, so the dwarves are relatively neutral in that. So again, it's not a shock to see where Disney was kind of coming from in having his, and of course, like, the dwarves aren't nearly so sort of slapstick and comical in the source stories as Disney makes them, but
right.
But it's certainly not like a massive departure. But anyway, yeah, there it is. So you've got these unexpectedly benign dwarves in Tolkien showing up to be the, you know, the numerous, and I would add largely faceless sidekicks. You know, despite the fact that Peter Jackson is, you know, going to make some of them hot and some of them funny and everything else in the film, in the book, you know, most of the dwarves are pretty indistinguishable from each other,
right.
And very few of them get any dialogue at all of any note, and have any role that differentiates them. Thorin, obviously, Balin is important, Phoebe and Kiwi get kind of separated out together, but never distinguished from each other, and never, not really.
And you know something? Yeah. It's interesting because Disney, because, you know, Jackson has specifically said, and of course we see this with, you know, the characters and we've been introduced to all the dwarfs,
right,
that Jackson has gone to, you know, much lengths to actually individuate, is that
yes.
a word,
yes.
each dwarf and give them their own personality. Disney did the same thing. He
right.
felt the need to do the same thing. And so there's actually a scene in I think it's when we see them at the – we first see the dwarves on at the mines in Snow White.
Mm-hmm.
He – you know, you get to know all the dwarves. And actually, the pre-release media and promotion, very much like Jackson, did a lot of here are the seven dwarves, here are their names, here are their characteristics. It's really interesting. I mean, it tracks almost parallel.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And of course, you can see how his Disney, that is, how his names are designed to emphasize that, right? I mean, he's got them named by their primary characteristics so that you only have to remember the one thing, right? You just have to, like, see this dwarf and associate sleepiness with it, and you've got
right.
Sleepy the dwarf. So, again, even their names. Like, you don't even have to remember two things about him. Like, this is his name, and he's kind of sleepy. Like, you just have to remember the one thing. That dude is sleepy. Clearly. And I think that's interesting. And, of course, you can see why. I mean, it's very understandable in both for both filmmakers, for Jackson and Disney. You know, you can have in a book a large crowd of relatively faceless people, and the reader's not going to be bothered by it, because unless that particular character is for some reason drawn to our attention, we can just be told, like, you know, the dwarves did this, the dwarves went there, the dwarves ran down the hill, and we're fine. Like, we can picture a group of dwarves, and we can separate them or we cannot. But to actually show them on screen and have, like, a bunch of people that you can't tell who's who, and it's just like this throng of, and then, you know, it has a very different effect.
Plus, there's no merchandising opportunities if you do it that way.
Right, exactly. And of course, both the Warner Brothers people and the Disney people were very quick on that. And that's another thing that I didn't even really know about Snow White. I think a lot of people would sort of might assume that Disney, you know, I mean, everybody knows how, you know, mercenary Disney is nowadays on merchandising and everything else. And, you know, a lot of people might assume that that's sort of a modern phenomenon and kind of imagine that, like, back in the days of classic Disney, you know, that he was making these films for, for serious artistic purposes and that, you know, now it's all been cheapened. But again, in your paper, you were showing that was really not at all the case.
No, in fact, yeah, he was quoted as saying, we just do movies and you professors tell us what it is we did or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, so it's the merchandising, I mean, I was fascinated.
Oh, the merchandising. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, you know, it was the 1930s version of, you know, McDonald's Happy Meals. I mean, I actually read a list of the kinds of things that were getting merchandised for this movie. And, you know, I think today we seem to think that this is a relatively recent thing, but not. I mean, think of all the things, the Legos and the Pez dispensers and everything you could think of today. There was an analog for that back then with this film. And that's another thing, you know, people might think, well, maybe Tolkien was, you know, here he is at his little ivory tower in Oxford, you know, he was, you know, probably not even aware. Oh, he was aware. He had to be aware. First of all, he had an 8-year-old daughter at home,
right?
You know, who I'm sure was very, you know, aware, if not, you know, clamoring for some of this stuff. His wife couldn't possibly go to the store without seeing, you know, Snow White on the dish soap or something.
Right.
So he definitely knew it was coming. And I mean, in Britain in particular, I mean, one of the sources that I found said the merchandising and the media splash was enormous before this movie came out.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is, again, it's a fascinating context. I mean, I don't see any, and, you know, in your paper, you were saying that it's hard to see any reason to suspect any actual crossover, any actual
right.
influence between one and the other. I mean, they were too simultaneous for that.
Right.
I mean, there was no way back in the early 30s when Tolkien was first writing The Hobbit that he had, you know, any idea. I mean, that Disney was doing this feature When was it that Disney announced that he was going to do it? It was several years before 30s. It was a 30.
Yeah, it was like third. Well, he actually one of the things that I didn't that ended up on the cutting room floor is a little story that's told by one of the guys that told about this. That in 1930, an evening in 1934, he got all of his animators into a soundstage, and 2 hours Disney enacted this whole entire story all by himself, and said this is going to be our movie.
All right.
And that was in 1934. Now, Humphrey Carpenter in Tolkien's biography has set 3132 for the approximate time that he believes Tolkien started The Hobbit.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, we're kind of in the same time frame, but they're in totally different worlds.
Right. Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, and there's absolutely no reason to think that, I mean, it's almost utterly impossible that Disney could have had any idea what Tolkien was doing.
Right.
As I mean, this was such a small scale project until it was published. And yeah, even though Disney was in 34, by then The Hobbit was written. So yeah, no, there's no way that they could have influenced each other directly. But yeah, the really interesting kind of crossover is, to me, that the merchandising stuff is what makes it particularly fascinating. And Tolkien, right at the moment when his book was being released, and people were reading this story of his, in which he had made this significant, certainly within his own world, this significant choice to put dwarves in this sort of heroic, ultimately heroic, anyway, role. Now he's surrounded by, you know, little plastic dolls and everything. And sort of, you know, his reactions to that. You did a great job of sort of summarizing Tolkien's negative reactions to Disney. He did not like Disney at all. Why don't you sort of share some of those viewpoints that he had and shared? And also, if you could, if you have them, do you have the dates with those?
Yeah, I think I do, actually.
Yeah,
you know, it's interesting. We have actually very few published or available to us comments from Tolkien on Disney, which I consider to be suspicious. I have a feeling that there was probably a lot more that he had to say, but let me just share some of the things. First of all, and also, he and C.S. Lewis went to see the movie together, by the way, in 39, and I'll also share in a moment if you want what Lewis had to say, especially about the dwarves. He did,
yes.
He hated the dwarves.
Yes.
So actually, before the movie came out, this is interesting because, and people have noticed this, but again, we go back to the merchandising thing, and this could be where it came from. Do we have an analog to a parrot in Tolkien?
I don't know, but actually it's
another
nice.
Room
it's
yelling
sort of
at me.
It's sort of like a...
Trying to find it here. Oh, okay.
It gives us her...
He says, when he's talking about... And so 1937, so this is before Snow White came out, he writes what's a pretty famous quote from him now, where he talks about that he loathes anything from Disney Studios. He was talking about anything... illustrators for the U.S. version of The Hobbit. He'd like it to be he'd veto anything from or influenced by the Disney Studios, for all of whose works I have a heartfelt loathing. Right. Now, this was like 6 months before the movie came out. But again, you know, we're having this huge merchandising thing going on. And
right,
the movie's already come out in the States, I think.
Yeah.
Or no, it actually hasn't come out in the States yet. But he knows it's there. And he's, I'm sure, been aware of the shorts.
Yeah,
you know, animated shorts.
Exactly. That was a, sort of the thing that I think is really important to comment on there. He knew Disney prior to the release of Snow White, that it wasn't just Snow White. So again, and that to me shows, you know, the coincidence of the dwarves and the fact that Disney is doing the fairy tale thing, and of course with Tolkien's own interest in fairy stories, it's, you know, it's impossible. Even if we didn't have the direct information, it would be impossible to imagine that Tolkien wouldn't have, you know, taken some interest in and made some comment upon Snow White when it happened. But it is interesting to see that evidence that he already knew about Disney before Snow White, that he was, you know, so he was already well aware prior to the release of the film, because he specified he wanted nothing in the Disney style in the illustrations of The Hobbit.
Right. so that's interesting, you know. So like I said, I think at one point in the paper, I suspect Disney was really not all that aware of Tolkien, but I think Tolkien was painfully aware of Disney.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, the next date I have anything for him mentioning Disney is actually been something that's been deleted in the book that Verlin Flieger and Douglas Anderson wrote about the On Fairy Stories speech and essay. I should say essays because there were different versions of it.
Yes.
They said that they're one of the emendations to the written version of On Fairy Stories, or one of the. I think from version one to version two, or draft A to final, was the removal of a disparaging footnote reference to the work of Disney, criticized for uniting beautiful external detail with inner vulgarity. And that's a quote. That's a quote from what he had said in his footnote. And I have a feeling somebody counseled him to eliminate that from his essay.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, here's the thing. The other thing that's interesting to me about this is that he gave that Andrew Lang lecture in, what was it, 1938, right?
Yes.
Well, he went – so Snow White was very much present in Britain, and I believe he actually went to see – Snow White right around that time. I have it written down in here somewhere. So Snow White and her dwarves were like very present in Britain at the time that he gave this lecture, and there is literally no direct reference to it whatsoever in his lecture. Now, I think if you look closely, there are probably a fair amount of indirect references to it.
Yes.
You know, and kind of some of the ways that he says stuff. But I just found that also an interesting time juxtaposition. So then the next same year, 1946, this is also in his letters, he sends a note to Stanley Unwin, who's, you know, his London publisher, about a German translation of The Hobbit and about some illustrations again. And he says, "I'm afraid that the illustrations are too Disney-fied. Bilbo with a dribbling nose and Gandalf a figure of vulgar fun rather than the Odinic warrior that I think of." So – all, you know, Disney means pejorative in his vernacular.
Yes, and notice there with Gandalf in particular, the way that Tolkien is contrasting, he's associating Disney characters with vulgarity and contrasting that with the Norse figure, right? The Odinic wanderer. Right. And that, of course, again, has a lot of relevance for the dwarf question, as, of course, the dwarves in The Hobbit are all, you know, their names are taken,
right,
from the Edda. So they are vaguely Norse anyway. They're not strictly Norse, but they're you know, sort of vaguely Norse in origin, at least in some ways. So again, there I think that we can see some of what he's sort of wanting to differentiate there. That the accusation of vulgarity I think is very interesting.
And that creeps up that comes up a lot. That kind of almost becomes his standard word whenever he talks about Disney. I mean, here's another example. Here is in a letter to his aunt. His aunt, I guess, had written a letter saying something about that the story of the Pied Piper was very popular among children. And Tolkien wrote back to her and he said, "I'm sorry about the Pied Piper. I loathe it. God help the children." He says, "I would soon give them crude and vulgar plastic toys, which of course they will play with to the ruin of their taste. Terrible presage of the most vulgar elements of Disney."
Yeah, yeah. And of course, Disney was associated with those vulgar plastic toys.
That's right.
That were filling the shelves when Snow White came out. So yeah, that's I mean, he's using that as a simile there, right? That he's comparing the Disney treatment to a vulgar plastic toy. But of course, they were the source. It was also the source of so many vulgar plastic toys. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. And I mean, vulgarity. And it's Lewis's too. Lewis also, calls him vulgar, which, prompted me to think, there were a few conversations in The Bird and the Baby about Uncle Walt, I'm imagining.
That seems possible.
And his dwarves, yes. Now, the next one is kind of interesting. This actually is not part of his letters. It's a letter that came up on auction in Sotheby's auction house. I'm trying to think how long ago it was. I can't remember. But the letter itself is written in 1964. And in it, he says, writing of Disney, he says, "I I recognize his talent, but it has always seemed to me hopelessly corrupted. Though in many of the pictures proceeding from his studios, there are admirable or charming passages, the effect of all of them is to me disgusting. Some have given me nausea.
Okay, but Tolkien, tell us how you really feel about
it. Ronald, tell us what you really think.
You really shouldn't hold back like that, Tolkien.
Well, I'll tell you, and he doesn't hold back because he goes on in this letter and says directly about Disney, calls him simply a cheat, willing and even eager to defraud the less experienced by trickery sufficiently legal to keep him out of jail. I should not have given any proposal from Disney any consideration at all. I am not all that poor. I know. And I looked into that, and actually that was the year that Mary Poppins came out in the theaters. And the author, P.L. Travers of the Mary Poppins books, English author, was apparently had a real love-hate thing going on. Disney apparently did kind of do a little bit of a bait and switch with her in terms of her artistic power over the movie. Mm-hmm. And she was virulently loud about her complaints.
Right.
And I have so there's speculation that what's closing to say about Disney is kind of based on the story that Travers, because you would imagine they probably knew one another, even if just lightly.
Well, and it's the kind of story that I would think that he would be sensitive to at this time. I mean, 64, so we're talking about it's not all that long ago that he himself was embroiled in the issue with the unauthorized Ace Book publication of The Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And I still have one of the copies. My oldest edition of The Hobbit, the one that I read when I was 8, is one of the old purple emu editions. That is, like with that freaked out cover that has the purple emus on it. Yeah. And like these huge, like pink globular hanging fruits and stuff.
It's like something from looks like something from Lewis's Venus fantasy.
Right, exactly. It does. It would be a much more fitting cover to Perelandra than to The Hobbit. But anyway, it's also one of those that contains that sort of authorial, that kind of grumpy and formal,
yes.
I mean, very justified authorial note on the back that says this edition and this edition only has been authorized, and those who approve of courtesy at the very least to living authors will purchase it and no other, because these other, books, basically he was being cheated and his book was being, unlawfully published. He had his own experience of, of being messed around with like this as an author. So I'm sure that, especially given how much he already clearly loathed
Disney.
And his works.
Oh, he was like fertile ground for Travers,
exactly.
To hear the story. Interestingly enough, as a side note, by the way, I found a reference in the Tolkien Companion, the two volume, this was actually in the second volume, that Joy Hill at Allen and Unwin in 1966, she was responsible for promoting Tolkien to the media, actually sent Lord of the Rings to Disney Studios. Now, I don't have any, it's got to be without his knowledge.
Oh, got to be.
I mean, there's no way. But here's the thing, the studio declined on the basis of the high cost to make such a film.
Yeah. Well,
imagine what would have happened if they'd been interested? Well, I mean, it wouldn't have happened, but Tolkien would have probably had his top of his head would have blown off.
What would have happened is we would have gotten a lot more material for this conversation because perhaps it would have been hidden in a box somewhere. But boy, imagining the smoke emerging from the cracks in the envelope that held the letter he sent to Allen and Unwin.
Oh, my God. Oh, I mean, I wonder if he ever did find out about it. I mean, I don't know if he did. I mean, there's no evidence that he did. But boy, if he did, I mean, he would have been just given some of the letters that I've read that he wrote. I mean, he was a real grump sometimes. And this would have just really made him grumpy.
Yeah. 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 Now, you mentioned also some of the things that C.S. Lewis said about it, which I think, of course, as always, I always feel like I have to give this disclaimer. Sometimes people, knowing that Lewis and Tolkien were friends, will look at things that one of them or the other said and basically sort of speak as if they both agree on everything, and, you know, a quote from one is a quote from the other, and that is not true, of course, you know. So what C.S. Lewis says doesn't mean that that's how Tolkien felt, but I think that we can see some pretty clear similarities between their assessments of Snow White in particular and Disney in general.
Well, and the thing that's interesting actually with Lewis, and I don't, you know, I'm so tempted to make some inferences here, which we of course I can't substantiate at all, but he actually saw it twice. I mean, when he went to see it with Tolkien, it was the second time he'd seen it. Mm-hmm. He and his brother went to see it first. That's interesting because Warren Lewis was, he considered the film, Warren considered the movie first rate.
Right.
And he loved the house cleaning scene with the dwarves, you know.
The dwarves, so, exactly.
I almost feel like Lewis may have said to, you know, Toller, listen, go see this with me because I need somebody who, you know, agrees with me to go see this movie.
I'm not seeing it with Warnie again. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like, but so Lewis, of course, in his so. I don't know. Should we call it snarky? I mean, I love what he says. So, I mean, it's just kind of fun. But he's in one letter to a BBC producer, he said, if only Disney did not combine so much vulgarity with his genius.
Ah.
So there's the vulgarity thing again.
Yep,
and then
yep.
There's a conversation with Jane Douglas, which is in a piece she wrote called An Enduring Friendship, where it was she went to visit him in his rooms in Oxford. They talked the afternoon away, and he said to her, "Too bad we didn't know Walt Disney before he was spoiled, isn't it?"
Yeah, and that, you know, that itself is such an interesting comment. You know, that, you know, he's not characterizing Walt Disney. He's not demonizing him. You know,
no.
It's like he's not like he is what ruined everything. You know, but that he himself has been ruined. That
he's been corrupted. Yes,
exactly. That he, you know, so seeing what this guy is doing and like this machine that this guy has built. You know, like the vulgar plastic toy machine and everything else. This is evidence of his own personal corruption, you know, that he himself has been corrupted, which is interesting.
Now, he says, he also says one other thing specific to Snow White. He concluded a commentary on the film, and this is out of his collected letters, but I don't remember if this is in a review or not. He says, what might have come of it if the man had been educated or even brought up in a decent society?
Like not America?
Yes, I know. I was like, whoa, can we get a little snobby here?
Well, you know. You know, yeah.
The other thing that he had a real problem with, Lewis himself did, was with the I'm trying to find it here. I do have a quote that he said specifically about the dwarves. He hated the dwarves. They were bloated, you know, kind of like featureless dwarves. They didn't act like dwarves that he considered dwarves. And, you know, what it made me think of are the dwarves that he populated Narnia with, which were actually a spectrum from good to bad.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, there is some differentiation there. They are definitely much more kind of Norse dwarves, obviously, than the Snow White dwarves are. But yeah, that accusation of vulgarity again is interesting, you know. And the sense, I think, that basically now, you know, of course, it's a, you know, neither of them ever sat down and did a long analysis or discussion of Snow White or Disney. So it's, you know, basically it's kind of left to us to sort of try to see what exactly they were talking about. And even to an extent, what exactly they meant by that particular accusation of vulgarity. And, you know, it seems to me, thinking about Snow White and, you know, thinking about the stuff that he says about, that Tolkien says about fairy tales and on fairy stories, as you mentioned, which, as you say, doesn't, you know, the text itself doesn't contain explicit references to Disney, but I think that we can see, you know, that he criticizes explicitly the Victorian traditions of, you know, fairy stories, and not just Victorian, but really like post-medieval. You know, starting with Drayton and whatnot. So he's criticizing Renaissance writers as well. You know, Shakespeare even.
Yeah, that's right.
But he, So anyway, so you know, he's explicitly talking about ways in which this thing has been cheapened and vulgarized as well. He uses the word there, and you think of what he talks of when he talks about pigwidgeon and what he calls pigwidgeonry, right?
Right.
And how the whole story is cheapened into, like, you know, instead of being made, taking these magical, these wondrous creatures. You know, and their sort of their otherworldly home, taking them and turning them into basically sort of back garden creatures living inside common flowers. And so let's take their world and let's make it just sort of small parts of our mundane world, which only seems wondrous because it's seen from a slightly different perspective. That is, bumblebees look a little bit more scary. And now, like, you're fighting, you can, like, duel with bumblebees and stuff when you're really small. So, okay, I mean, that's kind of cool, but... it's definite. But then, of course, what he really objected to, even more, was adding on top of that this really kind of sordid, you know, soap opera plot.
Right. Right.
That seems to be one of the things that he was objecting to when he called that stuff vulgar. And so,
right.
Again, you sort of think, what Disney is doing, how he is changing Snow White, and, you know, the ways, sort of the trends in his adaptations of fairy stories, and I think, in just using Snow White as a case study, I think there's a lot of interesting things that we can see, the way that the sort of the position that the romance plays,
right.
The way in which the dwarves themselves are really, well, I don't know. I was going to say cheapened, but that's not even sort of a fair word. I mean, they're made just purely comic relief.
Well, they're turned into Keystone Cops, basically.
Exactly. Exactly. Which, of course, is interesting, as this is exactly what, you know, one of the main things that a lot of Tolkien fans complained about Peter Jackson's films, right? That they turned Gimli
right.
into comic relief. So again, it's like a dwarf thing, right? Dwarfs are funny, I guess. And in both cases, you know, they were sort of the choice of the characters to be sacrificed for I was going to say almost pure comic relief. Gimli in the Lord of the Rings films is less pure comic relief than the dwarfs in Snow White, certainly.
True.
Gimli at least has his moments.
And at least his straight man is an elf.
Right. Right. Right, exactly.
But you know, it's interesting. In my paper, we know, you know, Tolkien's cauldron of story from Beyond Fairy Stories, you know, and his contention that, you know, these tales come from this cauldron and you ladle out piece, you know, parts of it like he did in The Hobbit,
right.
basically, you know,
right.
the Norse legends and whatnot. And what I kind of created a metaphor for Disney was I called it the pressure cooker of film.
Right.
Pressure cooker of film. I mean, he, you know, he had, given what he needed to do to make this appeal to audiences and theaters, he stayed as close to this Grimm's fairy tale, I think, as he could. But he needed to put in tropes, if you will, that the audiences were used to. At that time, at the time that Snow White came out, screwball comedies were very, very popular. And as we said, slapstick was very, very popular. You know, romantic comedies, you know, very, very popular. So I rewatched the animation, the movie, to do this paper. And once I had kind of become aware of those themes, boy, I mean, you could totally see them in the movie. And you can understand. It's like this was his very first animated feature. Just a little business background is they needed to make this work. You know, the shorts weren't getting the money in the door anymore. Things were changing. Talkies had come. And you know, there was a lot of things going on in the industry that Disney needed to have, you know, a win with this in order to be able to stay in business. And so he was pretty much at sort of, if you want to call it, the mercy of the tastes of audiences. And to my mind, Jackson is kind of in the same boat.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, especially when you think about where Disney was, with the fact that, again, this is the first feature-length animated film ever. So
right.
One of the things that he is sort of struggling with, or rather sort of one of the things he's placed against is the fact that a lot of people are going to come in assuming that, you know, that animation can't support like a full length serious film, you know.
Right. Animation. That's what the critics were saying at the time.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, this is a huge gamble on his part.
Exactly. So you can see his motivation to connect it with more serious feature films to kind of have it be a recognizable sort of legitimate film story in the traditions that people would expect from a serious film. But of course, you see, you know, what's so fascinating about this is that that's exactly what Tolkien was doing too, with the Hobbit,
with a fairy story, right?
With this
genre.
With people saying, "Oh, fairy stories are fine for like short little children's stories, but why would anybody, expect adults to take, you know, a novel-length fantasy story seriously?" And of course, The Hobbit wasn't really billed that way. It was billed as a children's book and was sort of accepted as a children's book. And of course, there were like polite jokes from his colleagues about why he was bothering writing this in his
spare
time.
They'd ask him how's your Hobbit doing?
Right, exactly. When he was on sabbatical, but anyway, you know, so the but of course, this is exactly a question that he himself embraces more and more, and that you see him embracing in the On Fairy Stories lecture and essay. This question of, well, you know, yes, why shouldn't fantasy be a perfectly legitimate mode in which to write for adults, and that it is possible to have, you know, a perfectly like serious novel, which is also a work of fantasy. And again, you know, and of course, that's ultimately what the challenge that he embraces in doing The Lord of the Rings.
Right.
But again, it's fascinating to see. It's actually quite similar to the position.
It
there
is.
Are differences. But Disney was confronting the same kind of thing. I find that very interesting. But again, one thing that I think we see a major difference in those two is, and this I think is perhaps where we can see some of the root of some of those accusations of vulgarity by Tolkien and Lewis. Tolkien's response to this challenge of, you know, how can you do something that people don't sort of assume can't be done, that is, everybody assumes that grown-ups aren't going to be interested in reading a full-length novel of fantasy. And his response was not to cater to anybody. Like, basically, he wrote this book that, makes, like, making no compromise with 20th century taste or novel conventions. And it's not that it's totally separated from the rest of 20th century literature. I mean, I know that sometimes Tolkien scholars who are medievalists will tend to speak sort of somewhat hyperbolically, as if, you know, Tolkien's works are simply medieval works that happen to be written in the 20th century, and that there's this like enormous gulf between the concerns of the Lord of the Rings and the approach to the Lord of the Rings and the approach of other 20th century literature. And it's not true. Tolkien's work was the product of his time, to a greater extent than often some people think. But nevertheless, you know, he was certainly not thinking about pleasing audiences. You know, he was not doing, his approach to it was very different from Disney's where Disney seemed to be like, okay, like what sells, what are the audiences looking for?
Right.
How can I give it to them while still
staying true to my vision.
Exactly. And even the choice of the fairy tale seems itself to be kind of bridging that particular gap, right? Like it's a fairy tale, so that seems like an appropriate thing to have a cartoon about, but we're going to do a feature film on it, you know, which is a much more serious undertaking. So so we're also going to, you know, make you think of like Fred Astaire and Errol Flynn and you know, during the film. I think that's
what really fascinates me with these two is, you said it, you know, they both kind of were sort of almost addressing the same thing, and they both had, you know, catalyzed enormous breakthroughs in their particular areas, and it's so interesting that both are kind of in the fantasy genre. I mean, it just is really an interesting study.
Yeah, it is. And but again, their own attitudes are so different. You know,
oh, yeah.
Disney is trying to get rich. You know, he is trying to make a mercantile success. You know, he was, you know, down to the, you know, like the Mary Poppins stuff you were talking about before, yeah. where, you know, we see some of his approaches being perhaps, you know, not what everyone would consider scrupulous, but, right. And certainly which Tolkien did not consider scrupulous. Whereas Tolkien, on the other hand, is not even, I mean, like, nobody was more surprised by the success of The Lord of the Rings than he was. And, you know, and he wouldn't, it wasn't even his idea originally to propose The Hobbit for publication.
Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, he wasn't even
right.
angling
it was just,
for that.
Because somebody knew somebody.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was interesting when I read that. You know, it was just somebody, a friend of the family who happened to know somebody at Allen and Unwin. And then, you know, she sent it on to her friend. And then Rainer Unwin, the 10-year-old son of the publisher, read it and gave his thumbs up. I mean, what an interesting series of coincidences or serendipity.
Right. Right. Yes, exactly. And I mean, I think that's, you know, that is, I think, a big, it's a huge difference in their attitudes. That is the one person who says, like, oh yeah, if little plastic figurines, you know, will both help to promote the film and also, and which was brilliant because it did, you know, and it does.
Yeah.
And also, you know, not to mention help in the, you know, in the making of our company very rich. That's, you know, basically Disney was willing to do that. And as he said, you know, flamboyantly and, you know, as you cited before, and perhaps exaggeratedly, but still, you know, like, oh, artistic vision? No. You know, like, I'm just making movies here. Like, I'm just
movie maker. And you professors tell me what I do after I do it.
I don't do art, right? Yeah,
I don't do art.
Exactly. And again, you know, that sort of sounds a little bit facetious to me, perhaps. But nevertheless, still, like, Tolkien is the utter opposite of that, right? I mean, like, somebody who was never thinking of it was so far from thinking about the merchandising possibilities, you know, who was the opposite end of the spectrum from self-promotion, and who was really thinking only of, you know, sort of the story and the thing that he wanted to do. And, you know, he wrote the book that he wanted to write and was really happy with it, really wanted to get it published. I mean, you know, it's not,
right.
You know, we can't over, you know, it's possible to overstate his lack of self-promotion. I mean, he was trying to get his book published. He was trying to talk publishers into it, and he desperately wanted to see The Silmarillion published too, though he failed at that during his lifetime. But anyway, so yeah, he certainly wanted it to be published, but basically he wrote the book that he wanted to write and was shocked to find that millions of people also liked it. But again, that I think has sort of necessarily a reflection in the actual products of these people. And that I think that one of the things that he seemed not to like about Disney is just that Disney didn't have anything like the same relationship with the fairy tale tradition that Tolkien seemed
right.
to have. His stuff wasn't thoughtful in the same way. Like, it was material that he was using,
mm-hmm.
And using well. But you know, he was not really. Again, you think about his relationship with the fairy story tradition compared to Tolkien's relationship, the way that Tolkien understood his relationship with the fairy story tradition. You know, I mean, it's like you read the first couple paragraphs of On Fairy Stories, you know, mm-hmm. and the kind of, well, it goes well beyond respect, you know, that he shows for fairy tales and fairy stories in that opening. You know, I propose to speak about fairy stories, though I am aware that this is a rash adventure. Fairy is a perilous land, and in it are pitfalls for the unwary and dungeons for the overbold. And overbold I may be accounted, for though I have been a lover of fairy stories since I learned to read, and have at times thought about them, I have not studied them professionally. I have been hardly more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder, but not of information. And it's just that kind
yeah.
of tone, you know, you can't imagine Disney talking like that.
No, not at all.
That's just not his relationship with this whole tradition and with the idea of fairy.
And, you know, actually even the media, and, you know, I take kind of media with a grain of salt in terms of the story of how Disney came up with Snow White, because, you know, those kind of stories get spun. But the spun story, if you will, of why Disney thought of Snow White was because as a 15-year-old boy, he had seen Snow White and the Seven Dwarves in the silent movie version and had been enraptured by it. So we're not even talking about him having read the fairy story.
Right. Right. And that's, you know, the thing that I find so interesting about that is, but you'll notice that he is spinning it a different way in the film itself. You think about the opening to the Snow White film, and it opens with the book sitting on the table next to a candle, right? And then,
right,
the, you know, the page is open and we have the illuminated manuscript. And it's not just like we see a book on the table and then the story starts. We're allowed to read two pages of the book, right, before finally the scene shifts and the action sort of, you know, comes alive and ceases to be printed on a page on the screen. That seems to be, I mean, my reading of that is that, you know, we're being invited as an audience to see this film as the continuation, as the extension of the written story, you know, that we have this, you know, this semi medieval-ish manuscript, right? It's not, because it's not a scroll or anything. It's an actual book, right? It's a codex, but it's, but anyway, it's, you know, it's illuminated like a medieval work. So we've got this old story. And then again, the cut from the book, I think it's the Wicked Witch that we start with.
Yeah, I think we start with the Wicked Witch and her mirror. Yeah,
exactly. You know, so the segue there, it seems to me to invite us to see the movie as in this kind of continuous tradition with the book. You know, this is the book now coming to life. Because he literally has a start off reading the story.
The inference there is what we're going to tell you is what's in the book.
Yeah, and it's not a voiceover. We're just shown silently the pictures on the page. The pages on the screen. Two pages on the screen. two sets of pages. And we're reading it there, everybody silently with just, there's music. But anyway, you know, no voice. And then we see the picture happening. So again, our own private reading of the words in the book on the screen becomes the film. So again, it seems to me pretty clear that the message he's trying to give at the beginning of the film is like, oh, this is the Brothers Grimm come to life before your eyes.
But this is one of the reasons I'm so cynical about movie studios.
Yeah. But I mean, I would suspect that Tolkien would really bristle at that implication, because what he was seeing was not that.
Right.
And it seems that what Disney was doing was not really that.
Right.
That's really just, again, kind of a spin that he's doing. And I don't know. I mean, perhaps Disney might be defended, on these fronts, from some of this stuff. But again, I think that, you know, those kinds of things, you know, not really kind of thinking about this tradition, and instead just kind of coming in. And I think, you know, people like Lewis and Tolkien would see him as just kind of ignorantly trampling on this tradition.
Right. Exactly.
For his own benefit.
In my thinking now, with the, you know, the recent Christopher Tolkien interview and, you know, kind of the conversations that sparked, I thought, when I was thinking about this paper again, I thought, well, you know, this is not new for Christopher to have these thoughts. You know, even before there was a problem with the new, you know, the royalty issue and the courtrooms and stuff like that. I mean, he's father's literary executor. Do you think they didn't have conversations about this? Oh, I'm sure they did.
Right. Exactly. And, and as I've said, I think it was in our Riddles in the Dark episode that I was talking about this, you know, I have all kinds of sympathy for how Christopher feels in the wake of, you know, the Peter Jackson films, because especially when you put it in the context, you know, thinking back to all this Snow White stuff and the Disney stuff, what he's seeing has got to be what Tolkien himself would have considered a kind of nightmare.
Right.
To see his own story. Now he, Christopher Tolkien, 75 years later, is surrounded by little plastic, cheap plastic
figurines
of Tolkien
and stuff. Vesta dispensers and Lego.
Exactly. You know, we've got Lego Shelob and Pez Gollum and yeah, you know, little Thorin figurines. And, you know, again, like, you know, I don't intend any of this necessarily I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but again, thinking, you know, going back into sort of Tolkien's own perspective, here he is with his Hobbit, and then later with his Lord of the Rings, and his relationship with his work and the way that his work is an expression of his relationship, you know, with these older traditions and everything. And then him looking over at Disney and being like, oh man, that is so vulgar. That is so crass. Mm-hmm. Like, this guy is just trying to cash in on this stuff and, you know, and not taking it seriously. And then for Tolkien's own work to undergo, you know, what
to Christopher's got to be a similar
exactly
thing. And even the questionable ethics of the studio,
right,
kind of thing,
exactly.
You know, I mean, that whole experience,
exactly, yeah. I mean, now all of a sudden they're Mary Poppins, right? I mean,
it's exactly
and I mean, it's not the same thing, it's not the same situation, but yeah, exactly, to the point where the studio did famously try to not honor the royalties contract.
That's right.
That Tolkien did sign. So anyway, it's
it does kind of fill in a little bit, you know, a little bit more. I mean, we were already sort of in sympathy with, you know, understanding where Christopher was coming from, but knowing this really even adds a little bit more of that backstory.
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think, you know, like I said, I find it very understandable. I mean, you know, I'll say it again, what I said before, ultimately the thing that I don't agree with Christopher on, the thing that I find a little bit sad, I guess, is that, no, I guess I would go so far as to say that I find it sad, is that basically, you know, he expressed in this interview with Le Monde that he had, you know, that he feels that now the story has been cheapened to the point where, you know, its impact is now zero and he can't
right.
even bear to look at it anymore. You know, what has been done to this story in the mind, you know, in the eyes of the general public. And that's the place where I strongly disagree with Christopher, and what I find sad is that, you know, I think that what he's missing, what he's not seeing, and I mean literally missing, what he's not seeing, what he probably has not experienced much himself, is basically conversations with people who have been introduced to Tolkien by the films, and, you know, for whom the films did. Even if you want to say that the films depict this vulgarized, you know, highly cheapened version of Tolkien's stories, even if you grant that fact, nevertheless, the vulgarized, cheapened version of the story retains enough power to draw people to read the
right.
books and has served as the gateway for thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are now people that I greatly respect as Tolkien scholars and as Tolkien readers.
Right.
You know, and that's this is going to be more true as time goes on. I mean, 20 years from now, it may well be that the majority, you know, I mean, it will almost certainly be that the majority of, like, you know, of serious Tolkien scholars and, you know, readers and students of Tolkien will have seen Peter Jackson's films before they read the books.
That's true. Now, what do you mean? There were books before
yeah,
the movies?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Oh, did they write a book version of those? yeah, exactly. But anyway, so yeah, and that I think is the thing that Christopher Tolkien is missing, that, you know, I don't think their impact has been reduced to zero at all. I have seen them retain a very powerful impact and have the films serve as, you know, the introduction, an effective introduction, to get people to read and to love those books who never would have done otherwise. And, you know, for that, I, you know, I have said and will always say that no matter how much, you know, any individual Tolkien fan, I know there are people who loathe the films, and I am very sympathetic to many of the things that they have, many of the criticisms that they have to make of the films. I totally get that. But at the end of the day, I don't think you can sit down and not say the films have been a net benefit for Tolkien studies. I mean, they have. I think that's
Absolutely.
Very demonstrable.
And I'll even say something more, even more revolutionary, which is I think if it wasn't for Walt Disney, I would never have read Lord of the Rings. And the reason I say that is because, I mean, I was raised, I think, let's see, Sleeping Beauty was that was probably really the first, you know, feature length animation that I remember as a really little girl. And I love Sleeping Beauty. And I, you know, watched it. And that actually, Disney's fairy tale movies, actually, as I got older, I ended up reading the original Grimm and Andersen fairy tales, which I totally fell in love with.
Right.
And so at a very young age, you know, I really loved fairy tale and fantasy. And so when the Ace paperback, like I actually did read the Ace paperback versions of Lord of the Rings, came, first The Hobbit and then Lord of the Rings came in, I ate it up. And I mean, you know, life has never been the same since. So.
Right. Yeah, you know, and that's actually really interesting. You think about that, because I mean, that is another thing that is unquestionably true. You know, all of the discussion of fairy tales and fairy stories in those Victorian, like, you know, that Tolkien talks about it on fairy stories mm-hmm. and the Lang tradition and everything else. I mean, let's face it, that's almost dead in our society.
Right.
I mean, you know, kids who have grown up within the last 20 years, where do they encounter fairy tales outside of Disney? I mean, you can find books about them, but even those are getting rarer. That is, like, ones that don't feature Disney characters. You know, actual, like, Disney's drawings. It is no longer, you know, one of the common traditions. And I know there will be exceptions, and, you know, as soon as I say this, like, you know, 1,000 people will email me and say, I was raised on the Brothers Grimm. I mean, and I don't doubt that there are people who do that, but it is not any more part of our culture outside of Disney. So, in fact, that fairy tradition, which Tolkien loved so much, and which he showed so much respect or even reverence for in On Fairy Stories, and which he clearly felt was being trampled on by Disney, that tradition, Disney is its primary legacy, is its primary transmitter now.
Disney's kind of like the first contact.
Yes, it would be almost dead in our culture if not for Disney. And the idea, I mean, just imagining Tolkien's response you know, in like 1937 or like 1940 or something, you could tell Tolkien, okay, 60 years from now, Disney's versions are Disney is going to be solely responsible for the fact that any, like, American children certainly even know who Snow White or Cinderella, you know,
are. Or dwarves.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, heck, Robin Hood, even, for crying out loud.
That's true.
I mean, there's a little bit more, because that still makes it into grown up films. But anyway, apart from that, you know, it's to say, you know, Disney is going to be the primary, and in many cases, even maybe the majority of cases, the sole transmitter of this fairy story tradition to the modern generation. Like, Tolkien would have wept told that. He would have wept and or raged to be told that. And yet, you know, as you say, nevertheless, like, still some fruit is born of that, you know, and again, I think that those parallels are really interesting, you know, that it's, like, you know, vulgarized, yes, but it's still, you know, the stories still do sort of retain that power. And once you find out, like, oh, you know, if you really like this story, there are these other stories,
right.
You know, there are these other versions, there are these older versions, there are these guys called the Brothers Grimm, then again, you sort of discover things, and anyway, but it is a really fascinating parallel.
It really is. I mean, I just found it very interesting. I do have one other thing I wanted to give an homage to Dr. Tolkien for. You know how we've talked about, and you've mentioned before, that he was kind of known to be not the greatest lecturer. You know, he kind of mumbled, and
as far as his actual
sometimes students
speaking
would find it hard,
yes,
you know, to understand what he was saying and whatnot. I wanted to give another side to this. That's out of the Tolkien Family Album, a book that was written by Priscilla, John and Priscilla Tolkien, and it's when he's younger, so he may very well have mumbled later. But this reminded me very much of Disney, especially when I read the part about Disney acting out Snow White for his animators. One of his former students wrote, and this is specifically around things like his reciting Beowulf or Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
Right.
He would turn a lecture room into a mead hall in which he was the bard and we were the feasting, listening guests.
Yes. And I think, I know that, you know, there are certainly, you know, others who sort of reflected on what a transformative experience it was being in his lectures. You know, I think of the comments that, you know, the poet W.H. Auden made about this. But yes, it's true that he was not very prepossessing in his – he spoke really quickly and was often difficult for people to understand.
Right.
It is very interesting. You know, I think there is a really good book in this. That is, like, there needs to be a really good book written on Tolkien and Disney. I mean, this it would be a fascinating study to really kind of dig into, you know, both sort of their stories, their approaches, to start with the parallels between them and their relationship with fairy stories, and their basically sort of being pioneers in their genres, and these very, very similar pioneers, as we said, you know, sort of bringing fairy stories to life in a, you know, it, or, you know, like, you know, fairy stories and fantasy to life in a genre which was considered to be, you know, sort of a serious grown-up genre,
right.
You know, the novel,
right.
Or the feature film.
Right. Anyway, I agree with you. I think there's a lot more to this.
Start really. From there and then kind of talk about their careers, their approaches, their philosophies, sort of compare and contrast their works. You know, look at their different relationships with the traditions that they were working in. I mean, this would be a big book, but it would be really cool. Somebody needs to write this. I don't have time to write this book, but somebody needs to write this book. So
Well, you planted the, you know, I'm an old Disney kid from way back. You couldn't get the ears off my head when I was like 4 and 5 years old, you know, so this would definitely be, I mean, I really enjoyed doing, I mean, you saw I did a lot of research on this.
Yeah.
It was just a fascinating, fascinating thing. So, you know, the next time I have free time,
exactly.
Maybe I'll work on that.
Yeah. You know, you should. You should. Somebody should. It should be done. I think, you know.
It must be told. It's a story that must be told.
It is a story that must be told. It's something that I think a lot of people, it's, I mean, once you glance at it, it's so obvious, you know, the connections between them, but yet it's very rarely discussed.
And like I say, the silences are loud.
Yes.
The parts that we don't know and the things that aren't published or said about this coincidence are loud in my ears. You know,
right.
I mean, I just think there was more said or written that just, because, you know, one of the things, and I was rereading Tolkien's will, because I got a copy of his will for this paper too. And one of the things that he gives, you know, Christopher permission to do, which I'm sure is not unusual as his literary executor, is not only to take his work posthumously and do what he wants to in terms of modifying and editing it, but also to destroy work that he feels needs to be destroyed. And that sentence kind of popped out at me because I could just see Tolkien's lawyers are telling Christopher, we really don't want any of this stuff about Disney coming to light because it could be a big lawsuit with Disney. You know, it's like, don't do that. Just get rid of this stuff. You know what I mean? I just could see that because Tolkien doesn't strike me as a person that was very reticent in his opinions.
No, he wasn't. And of course, exactly the kinds of quotations that you were reading from both Lewis and Tolkien was also very much like, it's not just that the two of them were sort of like particularly acerbic or cranky. That's kind of, it's like part of being, you know, a critic. Yeah, part of being, I mean, you read scholarship from the first half of the 20th century, and it's full of choice remarks like that. I mean, when they when they criticize something, they really criticize something, you know. And you know, they were not just for being polite, for the sake of being polite. They would just eviscerate things. That's actually a very sort of familiar tone.
Yeah. So I'm thinking that either anything Tolkien wrote, or, you know, any way he went on record with Disney other than what we've already got, has either been very deeply or literally does not exist anymore.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining me. This has been a fun conversation. Hopefully the beginning of a larger project. We hope to sort of see more from this. I hope certainly that somebody does it. But anyway, thank you very much for joining us here today. That was fun.
Yeah, it was fun for me too, and I got plenty more pipeweed, so, you know, happy to do it again on some other topic.
Yes, lots more figurative pipeweed, so excellent. Okay, well, very good. Well, so thanks for listening, everybody, and Godspeed.